This is the Friday edition on KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio. Cal Poly Humboldt Native American Studies hosted a Zoom call of their Decolonizing Sustainability Speaker Series on Wednesday, November 2nd. Forest Health is Human Health, Indigenous Forestry and Place-Based Solutions with Dawn Blake was the first in this series.
My name's Dawn Blake. I'm the Yurok Tribe Forestry Director. The Forestry Department is nested within the Natural Resources Division in the Yurok Tribe's infrastructure in the Natural Resources Division. That houses fisheries, forestry, wildlife, watershed, and carbon. So as we're talking about human health and forest health, I just considered for a minute, you know, the health of my people, and just looked at some quick statistics to see where we were with our representation of the U.S. population. And we're about 2% of the overall population of the United States. And off the top of my head, as I was putting this slide together, I just threw a few diseases on here that I know affect our community. Heart disease, cirrhosis, and accidents are the three leading causes of death for Native Americans currently, and also respiratory diseases. I switched that out. I don't remember what I had in there, but I had to leave suicide in there because that just seems like something that really skews or affects our life expectancy. So I just spent a little bit of time poking around on the internet to find out, you know, what our current life expectancy is, and that's about 71. And so I found that is approximately 9 years lower than the white population, and then also lower than Hispanics and Blacks as well. So that kind of paints a grim picture, I guess, but just something that I think is residual from our historical traumas and things that we're still trying to come to terms with. But I think that we do a pretty good job in building resilience, and we still have a lot to be proud of and a lot to fight for. And I think that I definitely recognize that there's ways to increase this resilience. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and my position on the Hoopa Tribe Education Board of Directors, you know, we've been considering trauma-informed care as a way to increase resilience for our youth population. One of the successful ways to do that is to really introduce a lot of culture and just provide a lot of opportunity for the youth to participate in culture. And that increases identity. But one of the things that, you know, kind of gets left out in modern society is also our spirituality. So it's really good for our kids to learn how to do math and writing and to graduate and to be, you know, productive members of society and, you know, be able to take care of themselves. But I think that because we have this, you know, really, we're in this really high risk category, taking care of ourselves means more than just learning the basics at elementary and high school. So we really have to nurture our culture in order for our health and growth. On that same note, building resilience in the forest is really important for us, and that affects us directly because if the forest doesn't have good resilience to things like fire and diseases, then that can have a direct impact on us as a people. So in the forced assimilation in the past decades, we've really kind of gone away, not by our own choice, of from things that we really relied on that were directly related to the health of the forest, like, you know, our foods, medicines, going out and foraging. So that when I'm making the comparison in today's society between how we were always on the landscape, you know, navigating that and doing that was really healthy for us. You know, that was exercise and building this relationship to not only the landscape, but, you know, to these various food sources, that ends up also being really a healthy thing to do. That really just makes me consider, you know, how I would like to spend my time as a forestry director. Restoration is becoming really important, and suddenly there's a lot of money for restoration. Last week, I was down at the California Native Plant Society Conference and listening to a lot of the stories on restoration in various counties. And, you know, it's nice that in recent years, there's a lot of restoration happening where the fuels are being addressed both mechanically and then with prescribed fire. So in a lot of senses, it feels like, you know, we're trying to take a snapshot for science purpose and make an assessment of, you know, the benefits or detriments of putting fire on the landscape. And that really concerns me because I think that we desperately need to get fire back on the landscape and at a much larger scale. So I'm really happy that a lot of agencies and just the sentiment about prescribed fire is increasing. There's a lot more awareness about it. In the last couple of decades, there weren't a lot of people who were versed in it. And I've always heard that, well, you need to reduce the fuels so much before you ever go in there with prescribed fire. And that just seemed like such, it just really seemed like that was something that was in the distant future to us and where I was in my career. And so it's really refreshing to hear so many agencies and people all together talking about the need to get prescribed fire. So I think it's great. And I think that the traction that it's gaining and that we have so many participants in it. I just came from my third Board of Forestry meeting. And at every meeting, they're talking about, you know, individual people who work for Cal Fire are talking about their wonderful experience at TREX. You know, they're going and volunteering their time there to learn about cultural burns and then coming back with a greater knowledge about the ways that natives want to use fire on the landscape. And so I guess just my point is that that's all really great. These small prescribed burns as they increase are really good for our land, but we really need more of it. And at a larger scale. So I'd just like to have that discussion more often. And so the wondering about science and looking at the snapshot, since there's been fire exclusion for so long, I really am concerned at just considering the snapshot right now. And so at this conference that I came from, there was a lot of talk about, you know, species diversity and richness. And those are just common ways that you can assess, you know, the vegetation in science. And so that really got me thinking about, you know, since fire's been excluded from the landscape for the last 100 years, and we're taking a snapshot right now, I'd really like to know, and there aren't any answers for how the species diversity and richness right now, it differs from what it was when the land was continually managed with fire for all those centuries before fire exclusion happened. So in those 100 years, how could that have filled in? Do we have more of a homogeneous landscape now because just the management essentially stopped altogether? And I don't feel like there's ever going to be any answer for that. So it's always going to just be my question back to those who are trying to get answers in a scientific fashion. But maybe we can start to broaden our questions. I'm not sure what the answer to that is, what kind of hypothesis is going to capture what I'm looking for, but it's just something to think about and something that I've considered. So the photo is of basketry material, and those are the things that we really promoted. So maybe there weren't as many species of everything. The species wasn't at, you know, a height, but these things that we really depended on, basketry materials and medicines and foods, you know, those are the things that we were deliberately promoting. Much like in today's society, the timber companies are deliberately promoting, you know, trees to grow them fast and to be able to sell them, because in today's society, that's how you eat. You make industry out of that. So this is kind of at a smaller and more personalized scale for us, but we were definitely managing for what we wanted out of the landscape. I just wanted to share these objectives of the National Resource Management Act. I think that as I came into this forestry director position, I realized that there is kind of a competing or maybe even conflicting objective that we're going for. So the stuff that I was just describing, that's not what really the Congress passed on behalf of Native Americans for forest management. So we're looking at 1 through 7 and considering maintaining the forest land perpetually, you know, for productivity, for marketing objectives, again, productivity and perpetual forest business, added value, you know, of the forest commodities. This one, retention, I can't read it because retention of such land in its natural state when Indian tribe determines that the recreational, cultural, aesthetic, and traditional values of the land represents its best use. I think that's all the stuff that I described, and I think that's something that was really important for tribes when this was passed. And I do recognize also that this was passed because tribes were coming forward with these needs, but you know, I think that where we are today in talking about how we use the forest, in order for the forest to become more useful to us and for us to maintain this connection to it, this number 5 can't be such a luxury. It has to be more of a management goal. And then protection of forest resources by regulating water runoff, soil, the improvement of timber productivity, grazing, wildlife, fisheries, and specified traditional values. So I think that's all really pretty compelling, but I just wanted to include this as a slide to recognize that, you know, that was a really great thing that happened for us in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, but you know, we're realizing in the decades since then that we need more, and that there, I feel like what that was in response to was the management of the past couple of decades. So now that I've been in this field for a little while, I realize that these decades go by fast, and what I want to do in my position right now is in response to the management of the last couple of decades. And so I would love to be able to tier with that act and then move to the next level. And I think that's along the lines of landscape fire management. So ecosystem. This has been a discussion for a while that, you know, I think that we're moving from, or have already moved from the concept that wilderness is without people. I think that it's pretty well understood at this point that humans are part of the ecosystem, and our indigenous management was also part of the ecosystem. We're part of the ecosystem, and the services that we provided to the ecosystem was important for just everything. Everything's interconnected. So as part of the ecosystem, we're entwined in this sweet interconnection, like mycelium and the mycorrhizal associations. So I just wanted to describe ecosystem services a little more. I'm not sure who my audience is. I can't really see who's participating in this, but at my graduate lab here at Cal Poly Humboldt, that lab, Matt Johnson's lab, is especially interested in ecosystem services. So I attended a lot of these presentations that had to do with ecosystem services. So Matt and his career has looked at birds and how they on farms often provide ecosystem services to farms that is beneficial to humans, because hopefully rather than having to put a lot of money into pesticides, you have a natural pesticide by promoting birds going onto farms, and then birds eat the pests that damage the crop. And so that's an ecosystem service. Another example of ecosystem services that my lab looks at are barn owls, and promote putting barn owl boxes at farms so that barn owls have a place to rest and nest, and then hopefully they are able to have an effect on the rodent population. And then another ecosystem service that my lab studied was in Hoopaw. When I first came to my job as a wildlife technician in Hoopaw, there was an emerging problem with bears eating the trees. And as Hoopaw had a forest industry, that seemed like it was going to be costly in the millions in the future. So bears were damaging the trees, and that was just going to seem like a total loss. So about 20 years later, one of my labbies and coworkers did her graduate research on the bear damage in these what were large clear cuts of the 80s. So in those large clear cuts, there was still pesticide application during those time. So one of the first things that really made an impression on me when I started there was that these expansive forests were basically only trees. And my boss called them sterile environments, because you couldn't really hear birds in there. You couldn't really see bugs. There was just like not a lot of animals moving around, rodents or anything. So the ecosystem kind of broke down when this forest was only grown to be trees or just growing trees really fast. And then the other life forces in this forest are just, it's devoid of these other life forces. So, after 20 or more years, where the bears were going in and killing trees partially or damaging or killing trees, it's providing standing dead trees, which welcomes in bugs, which welcomes in birds and woodpeckers. And suddenly, we didn't see this coming, but suddenly the bears are providing an ecosystem service that ends up being important to us culturally, because woodpeckers are a cultural icon. So that's an example of ecosystem services. And I wanted to make that comparison with the animals and how animals provide ecosystem services, but humans also provide ecosystem services. And that's what I was talking about. So before I go back into that discussion, I hope I remember to, but woodpeckers also provide ecosystem services. So as you may know, woodpeckers put cavities into trees, and those cavities provision habitat for other animals There's a large list of animals that use the cavities that woodpeckers put in, and it's relative to the size of the woodpecker. The size of the woodpecker determines the size of the cavity, determines the size of the animal that would use that cavity. So pileated woodpeckers put in the largest cavities, and so you would expect the animals that use those cavities to be larger animals like squirrels, fishers, but downy woodpeckers on the other end of the size spectrum for the representative woodpeckers put in really small cavities, and then small animals would be expected to use those cavities. So like Western bluebirds, or maybe some species of owls. Anyway, woodpeckers put in a lot of work to put in these cavities throughout the forest. And these cavities end up being highly important to this habitat. Wouldn't exist for animals to nest, roost, reproduce, den, if not for the work of these woodpeckers. So when you have a forest that's devoid of these trees that a woodpecker is going to want to put a cavity in the first place, they always put cavities into trees that already have a little bit of heart rot. So they know somehow they have a sense for a tree that has heart rot. So this picture is really interesting because it's a live tree, and often they want to use dead trees because they definitely are going to have rot inside. And there's definitely going to be, you know, when they excavate into it, it's going to be a little bit easier to take the material out of it and to provide this space. So when a live tree is used, they just have some sense for the rot that exists within the tree. And so the rot ends up being kind of important. I think that's kind of counterintuitive if you don't know much about the forest, or, you know, in talking to a lot of foresters, I hear about healthy trees a lot. And, you know, in a lot of projects, people want to remove the unhealthy trees and promote the healthy trees. And I'm kind of the opposite of that. We need some unhealthy trees because this provides for woodpeckers and then the habitat for so many other animals. So, I mean, I read not too long ago, it wasn't definitive. And I think that if I research this a little bit more, I'll have a better understanding of it, but it was enough to read that and make the correlation that a lot of the animals that are in peril right now are cavity nesting or denning animals. And that's to be expected. And I think that woodpeckers really do great. And, you know, the tribes, we want woodpeckers on the landscape. So we definitely are promoting snags and promoting habitat for woodpeckers. So that in turn helps a lot out the entire ecosystem. And that heart rot that occurs within a tree, that needs some initiation too. And we need recruitment of that. And so that's how natives are ecosystem engineers, because there's only a few ways for a cavity to occur. You know, there has to be some rot, and sometimes limbs come off trees. Sometimes there's some kind of damage from another tree falling down, scarring the tree, allowing the opening for the inoculation of this heart rot to enter the tree. But another way is by prescribed fire. So these fire scars give an opening and allow for this inoculation to happen. And so too many healthy trees is not a good thing to animals. And, you know, in my schooling, I always heard that, you know, dead and dying trees were really important, but just I'm realizing that the recruitment of those dead and dying trees is a really long process, and we don't have another 100 years to help along that process without fire being a part of the equation and without humans being a part of the equation. So for that, our relationship to the landscape is really important. And all these things that we rely on the forest for These are just, you know, again, just a few off the top of my head: acorns, deer, fish, basketry, huckleberries. I included this picture of my sister who recently started making, I think she's been making baskets, baby baskets, for a couple years. It may be maybe more than a couple years by now, but I'm really just so pleased at her relationship and understanding, you know, what time of year to gather her basketry material, her putting herself in the right frame of mind to sit down and weave something. It lends to her own health to both go out and gather the basketry material and then also work with the basketry material. And so that's kind of been my spiel for the last few years, is that the relationship is so important. When people fish and go out and actually are going on to the water, getting their own fish, processing it themselves, you're just, without thinking about it, you're developing this relationship with this animal that is really important to us. And you can't help to appreciate something when you spend so much time with it. You know, you begin to appreciate the morphology of it, the differences, the individual variation, and that ends up just being relationship. So, you know, I feel like we need to make a concerted effort into making and promoting these relationships rather than just, you know, when you go to the grocery store and get your meat out of a package and you're only looking at this packaged meat, you don't really make the association that this packaged meat was once an animal. And so, you know, I don't really feel that much relationship to my hamburger or realize, I do realize that it came from a cow, but just I'm so removed from the process that, you know, it just, it loses some meaning. And this is an example of an FVS, forest vegetation simulator model, where the forest that we're trying to address is just extraordinarily overgrown. And on the left-hand side, the basal area in some instances, in many instances, is over 300 basal area. And so we're trying to take that down to approximately 80 to 100 basal area on average. And so you can see the difference for what we are going from and what we're trying to go to. And so this forest is so dense that natural thinning is already happening, where some trees are out competing others and the losers are just falling down and dying. So this is a great example of the lack of management in recent decades and what happens when, you know, when you're not going in and either doing mechanical treatments or treating the landscape with fire. It's just a complete overgrowth and really a high risk situation for wildfire. And it's on a ridgetop. So, you know, this is on ridgetops is where they put fire lines. So there are way too many trees, way too close to each other in this area. And we're trying to address that for both fire resilience. And then it's also going to opening it up in the case of hardwoods is also going to release some of the tan oaks. And then those tan oaks that are just competing in this competition for resources are going to be able to switch over into reproducing, hopefully. And so that'll create habitat, gathering, and just produce altogether a healthier forest ecosystem. And then we have a prescribed fire component included with that. So we're hoping that that will also help the ecosystem by initiating some of those fire scars. I really like working at the Yurok tribe. I like the idea of being able to implement some of these things that are like very near and dear to my heart. But I say regularly that I really like working for the Yurok tribe because they operate close to their value system. And I am really compelled by the fact that every time they come together, they do it in a good way and start everything off with a prayer. And I feel like that really just grounds you and brings you back to why you're doing this, what you're here, that the what you're here for, that there are people and everything that you have to consider when you're making your decisions. And that's still my favorite thing. Thanks for having me.
We've been listening to Don Blake, Director of Forestry for the Yurok Tribe, on Forest Health is Human Health, Indigenous Forestry and Place-Based Solutions. These decolonizing sustainability talks will be held every Wednesday in November from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. via Zoom through Cal Poly Humboldt. You can check their website for a schedule. The Friday edition is a production of KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio. We thank you for listening.